So good morning. This is the first lecture of the string theory course. We're going to devote the next 3 weeks to understanding the very basic elements of string perturbation theory, which is the typical way people get into the subject of string theory. So the Polchinski volume one contains most of the material that we're going to discuss. We also be given lecture notes, which follow quite closely my lectures. The subject can get a little bit technical, and might push your knowledge of quantum field theory in unusual directions. And so to sort of avoid getting lost, I will devote a couple lectures at the beginning to sort of give you a map of what we're going to do sits in the context, in the greater context of string theory, theoretical physics. So to begin, I would like to explain what string perturbation theory means. So I also, please ask questions. I will try to periodically stop for questions, but I always often forget. So interrupt me. So as the name suggests, string perturbation theory is a perturbation theory. It tries to express, say, scattering amplitudes of whatever quantities you want to compute. As a power series, a formal power series in some coupling, starting from amplitudes for a free theory. So string perturbation theory tries to give a perturbative description of the motion of relativistic strings in space-time. So you should envision it as a theory that describes the way these one-dimensional objects move and occasionally interact with each other. In a manner that is completely analogous to the way quantum field theory describes the behavior of, well, perturbative quantum field theory describes the behavior of particles which propagate through space-time and occasionally interact with each other. So there is a picture which perhaps I could already put on the board. So when you study quantum field theory, you typically study perturbative quantum field theory for a while. And the typical picture is that you have some particles which, say, come in from infinity, propagate through space-time, interact with each other, and after a while, propagate back to infinity. So this is the basic picture of a quantum field theory scattering amplitude as with coupling. So the particles propagate freely for most of the time, and occasionally they interact at specific locations in space-time. So this is an example of a process which contributes to some quantum field theory amplitudes. Now, in string perturbation theory, we have one-dimensional objects in space which propagate in time. Yeah, I don't know how to do it well. that. Okay. So the strings moving in space-time form worksheets, which are two-dimensional. And these worksheets can interact with each other and propagate. One interesting difference, which will play a very important role, is that string worksheets can interact smoothly, while particles have to have special interaction points. See, these worksheets can join with each other and split without anything singular happening. So now a difference between string theory, string perturbation theory, and quantum field theory is that in quantum field theory, you do have a perturbative expansion, but you typically also have a semi-formal non-perturbative definition of the theory. So somebody could tell you, okay, take a path integral with some fields and some action. And this path integral will define for you the quantum field theory. And then if you expand in power series in the interaction strength, you will find this perturbative expansion. So in quantum field theory, you usually think about perturbation theory as an approximation to an underlying theory which is known. It might be very difficult to understand, but is at least in principle known. This is not the case in string theory. So we'll define string perturbation theory, but without an underlying non-perturbative definition of the theory. Such a non-perturbative definition is available in some very restrictive circumstances, but is not known in general. So finding a general non-perturbative definition of string theory is a gigantic open problem. Even understanding what that would actually mean is quite an open problem. So on the other hand, a way to understand how this is possible is that although you can derive perturbation theory from a path integral, you don't have to. Just telling me what are the basic particles and the basic interactions and requiring the scattering amplitudes to be, say, unitary and self-consistent in many different ways is usually enough to fix the perturbative expansion completely. Indeed, understanding to which degree this is true and using this to compute perturbation theory and quantum field theory is still quite an interesting subject of investigation. You learn to do perturbation theory with Feynman diagrams, but that's definitely not the most efficient way to do perturbation theory and quantum field theory. Now, in string theory, in a similar way, once you say that you're studying propagating strings and that they're interacting smoothly with each other by joining and splitting smoothly, then more or less the whole structure is implied. Although solving the problem is not easy, but it's been done. So people have learned how to find solutions to this problem, to find explicit definition of all the terms in this perturbative expansion, which make the whole thing self-consistent. Do you have any questions? Okay. So I will review a little some of the reasons we believe that some underlying theory exists for which this is a perturbative expansion. But again, it's not a simple problem to understand what that precisely means. But from now on, when I say string theory, I will refer to some unknown conjectural theory which lies behind this perturbative expansion. So the analogies between string theory and quantum field theory are particularly strong at low energy. So strings come with an intrinsic length scale, a tension, which is very analogous to the mass of a particle. And this tension more or less sets the scale of the internal motion of the string. So below, if your energies which are very, very low compared to this scale, the strings more or less sit in their own ground states, and they are compact objects with some internal degrees of freedom. Very, very, quite analogous to something like a nucleon or a nucleus or an atom or a molecule. So, for example, if you take a nucleus and you study it at very low energy compared to the energy needed to break it, how does it look like? Anybody tell me, how does a nucleus look like at low energy? Come on, it's a new experiment to ask questions to the audience. Let's not. Yes, precisely. So if you take a nucleus of oxygen, look at low energy, it's a particle with some charge, some mass, some maybe spin, some magnetic monopole, some magnetic dipole moment. If you heat it with a gamma ray, you might excite it. You'll find an excited state with the nucleus, which will have a different mass, maybe a different angular momentum. It will behave like a new particle. So you could study this at very low energy, the theory of these nuclei moving around and interacting occasionally through interactions, we transform them. Of course, if you look at higher and higher energies, you start exciting more and more excited states of these nucleus. At some point, the nucleus might break. You might discover there is some more internal structure. But in any case, the approximation that the nucleus is a particle breaks down. Something similar happens for strings. So if you take strings at very low energy, whatever you see will look like this. There will be some low energy states for the strings, each of which look like particles, which is on individual properties. These particles will interact through some low energy effective Lagrangian, which is determined from the string theory, from the string perturbation theory. There will be some tower of particles of increasingly high masses that come from exciting the internal states of the string. The main difference is that the string does not break down into more elementary components, at least not within perturbation theory, as you explore higher and higher energies. Instead, the string becomes something different from a particle. So at high energy, the scattering amplitudes of strings behave in very different ways from the ones of particles. You can really see that the strings are fluffier than the particles. You know, if you explore a nucleus with very high energy electrons, right? You at some point you see that there are points like quarks inside, by the fact that they scatter out at very large angles. If you scatter strings against each other, at some point they stop bouncing off at very large angles. So there are two properties that really distinguish string theory from quantum field theory from the very beginning. So So the first property is that if you look at these low energy states of a string, one of those states is a massless graviton. This is not something that happens in quantum field theory. If you have a quantum field theory,
And you don't put the graviton there to start with. Well, if you put a graviton there to start with, it's not a quantum field theory. It's a theory of gravity. And a graviton can never emerge from something which is not gravity within quantum field theory. So you never start with a theory, I don't know, of gluons and photons and quarks and find a graviton at low energy. Instead, in string theory, among the low energy states, there is a graviton. This is just a perturbative statement, okay? Just telling you what are the subtle things which you see when you scatter strings. You see a graviton. Massless. Another statement is that string perturbation theory is free of ultraviolet divergences. So if you try to study a perturbative quantum field theory with a graviton, you will encounter very serious problems. Now, there are all sorts of difficulties when you try to study, put together quantum mechanics and gravity. Some of these difficulties are very non-perturbative and very deep. I don't know, cosmological problems, black hole evaporation. But there are some very practical problems already in perturbation theory. So when you try to that a theory with gravitons is not normalizable. It has UV divergences, which cannot be dealt with easily. It also has very serious problems with high energy. If you scatter gravitons with each other, the amplitude of the scattering amplitude just grows polynomially at high energy. At some point, you violate unitarity. Now, these problems might be cured in a natural theory of gravity in many different ways. For example, you could say that high energy problems should not worry you because when you reach the Planck scale, something very non-perturbative happens and black holes form or this and that, and you need to change your perturbation theory is invalid anyway. But it's also possible that these problems could be solved within perturbation theory before you get to the Planck scale. So perturbative string theory provides a theoretical environment where this second possibility occurs. So in string theory, at low energy, you have a graviton. You start raising the energy. Before you encounter the usual problems of perturbative gravity, particles stop making sense. You reach the string scale, and you get into string theory, which is UV finite. It's probably true, although not proven yet, that this is that the converse is also true, that whenever you try to solve the problems of quantum gravity perturbatively, you will probably land on something like string theory, in the sense that you can at least prove theorems that nothing within quantum field theory will solve those problems. No matter which particles you add to your theory, you'll not be able to eliminate these problems. But unless you add infinitely many particles. And then the sort of infinite towers of particles tend to organize themselves into strings. So, as I said, this is not the only way quantum gravity could solve these problems. Indeed, even within string theory, there are situations where the first possibility I mentioned occurs. You study M theory. In M theory, there are no strings. There is no string scale. Whatever happens to fix the problems happens at the Planck scale. And we don't know what happens. We know M theory exists. We know some of these properties, but we don't have a perturbative expansion to explore it. I will mention what M theory is later. So these are the reason people started studying string theory. You know, they were looking at scattering amplitudes with some particularly nice properties, then they realized they came from strings. And when they found that there was a graviton and the theory was infinite, things looked quite interesting. Now, there is another property of string theory which is somewhat celebrated, which is the lack of continuous deformations. So let me explain. When you study quantum field theory, typically you have a whole bunch of continuous choices to make. You might have one interaction strength, multiple interaction strengths for different types of interactions. You'll have masses of particles in your bare Lagrangian. What all the numbers in your Lagrangian are just parameters that have to be fixed to experiments. Quantum field theories come in families. Now, on the other hand, now the same thing is true when you study string theory. When you look at the free propagation of strings, it looks like you have a lot of freedom of choice. For example, when you study strings propagating in a space-time, you get to pick the metric of that space-time. So, the free and the same is true in quantum field theory, of course. But something very striking is that for every continuous parameter in your string theory, there is a corresponding massless particle, which expresses the fluctuations in that parameter. So for example, although it's true that you can couple string theory to the ground metric, in the theory there is a graviton, which means that the metric is actually dynamical. It's not a parameter, it's a field. So the same is true for all other continuous deformations of the theory. String theories don't come in continuous families. They are isolated points. And all the continuous parameters are dynamical. So this also seemed very nice, right? It means that if you define a string theory, and it works like quantum field theory, but has no parameters, we should be able to just do some very complicated calculation and check what happens when we scatter two particles in real life, and it either works or it doesn't. So string theory seemed to be a very nice candidate for a theory of everything. No free parameters to play with. It either works or it doesn't, naively. Now, this property has a sort of a darker side. It means that all these parameters are dynamical, which also means that everything you see at low energy is the result of a dynamical process. The laws of nature in your universe are the result of a dynamical process. They're not fixed. And so the perturbative string theory gives you an immense space of possible things that seem to make sense, a big space of possibilities which can be dynamically explored in principle by the universe. But it doesn't give you much insight on how the universe is actually going to explore those possibilities. So a universe based on string theory will look like something, but we don't know what, even if we define the string theory. And is that, how does it look like might depend on your initial conditions or boundary conditions. So you might be able to describe many, many different, completely different looking universes using the same laws. Because all, right, everything is dynamical in the theory. So this is a bit of a cautionary tale about against the idea that we can write down a theory of everything. This is not just a feature of string theory, presumably. Through the ACFT and through holography, one can make some vague arguments that this is probably a property of any quantum theory of gravity. So string theory, use string theory or not use string theory, we'll have to face this problem that things are dynamical. The way the universe looks is dynamical. Even if you formulate some unique set of laws, you still have to figure out which dynamics gave rise to the universe you live in.
Did you see the string theory have free parameters?
There are no continuous parameters. So even the strength of the interaction, for example, becomes a field called the dilaton. So how strongly do strings interact is not up to you to decide. You can define your perturbation theory and say, oh, this is a nice description of the theory when the coupling is small. But you have no idea if the coupling is going to be small. The coupling will do what it wants to do dynamically. There will be some potential for this scalar field to do something. It might go to strong coupling, in which case your initial description of the theory is useless. So these are interesting challenges within string theory and outside of string theory. So in the lectures, we'll be able to see these three aspects emerging quite in detail. There are a few other, there is another topic which we'll discuss in the second half of the course, which is quite important to understand how string theory looks like, which is, let me go here, something called deep brains. Actually, before, do you have any questions? Please.
So there's little islands of string theory, or not islands, there's individual points for possible string theories. And each of those points, you could feed its boundary conditions, which will give you a string theory, or a different dynamics.
Right, so each of these points has a complicated space of dynamical possibilities that can be explored. And also, a lot of these points are actually the same point secretly. So there is another picture that I will draw momentarily, but maybe I can already draw it. So for example, there are a whole bunch of consistent perturbation theories for string theory, string perturbation theories, which we'll learn how to define. There's something called type 2A, type 2B, heterotic string of two types. There are a bunch of other possibilities. Each of these, as I said, is like it's a point which has a lot of structure, right? A lot of moduli, a lot of possible deformations. And if you follow the deformations away from weak coupling, you find that all of these merge. So,
each of these theories are points.
No, I mean, each of these theories have no continuous parameters, but they have some discrete choices which distinguish them. You know, the specific properties of the strings you used at the beginning. And they have some dynamical spaces of possibilities. You know, this field, there are some fields whose value control the coupling or the interaction strength.
For example, each of these points has a certain number of fields which given properties. And
that's right. And all of them have a dilaton, which controls the strength of the interaction.
Okay.
And if you move away from the region where the interactions are weak, it turns out that these theories can be connected to each other. So all the consistent perturbative string theories appear to describe different aspects of the same underlying theory, string theory. And there are other casks which are not string theories. But if you explore the region of the space of parameters, you might land in other places about which you understand much less.
What happens to the non-continuous parameters as you move from one of these, from one to the other? Do they just suddenly change? Or?
Right. So before that, before I can explain that, I need to discuss deep brains, and then I'll be able to answer that question. So deep brains are a way to add a bit of extra structure. So in a quantum field theory, you have a lot of freedom in building a theory. Right? Quantum field theories are like a toolbox. You have a bunch of possible fields you can pick, a bunch of possible interactions. You can decide which fields you include, which interactions. You can make a very complicated theory out of individual irreducible pieces. And it's up to you to decide which one to include and which one not to include. Now, in theories of gravity, that's probably not quite the case. For example, you cannot make a theory of gravity with two gravitons. There are some restrictions. And so string theory is similarly restrictive. When you study a theory of closed strings, you have these closed strings. There's some natural interaction with each other. But it's not easy to add something else to it. So string theories tend to be sort of maximally extended. But there is one way you can make pictures like this more complicated, which is to add open strings. So here I was describing objects which are closed loops propagating in space-time. You can have open lines, segments. So that don't mean drawing pictures that perhaps look like this. And now here my drawing skills will fail, presumably. But I'll try. OK, I don't know if this is very clear. I'm trying to describe a worksheet which has both tubes and open strips propagating in space-time. Now, when you let the strings have endpoints, you may get to make some choices on how these endpoints behave. You might force all the endpoints to behave in the same way, or you might allow a list of possibilities for what endpoints can do. These possibilities are called D-brains. So adding a D-brain to string theory means add one entry to the list of possible things the endpoints can do. For example, one D-brain might be something space-filling that says, OK, this endpoint of the string can propagate everywhere in space-time. Or a D-brain could be a localized object. It could say, oh, this other type of endpoint of strings can only propagate on this in this location of space-time. So I'm going to draw another picture in a moment. But first, so the endpoint sort of can have a color. And actually, the term color here is used on purpose, because theories of open strings often give rise to non-abelian gauge theories at low energy. So in the same way as gravity emerges naturally from closed strings, non-abelian gauge theories emerge naturally from open strings, with different types of endpoints behaving just as different colors of a gluon or a quark. So in space-time, you might want to say, OK, I have some D-brain which fills all space-time. I have some other D-brain, which is a line in space-time, maybe another one which is a hypersurface in space-time. And I will have closed strings. I'll have open strings attached to some of these objects. I'll have open strings between different objects. I can get my theory much more complicated in a consistent way. So from this point of view, right, these D-brains look like, again, when you look at the free theory, these D-brains are like some extra choice you made. How many do you put? Where do you put them? But then the same phenomenon happens that you get low energy excitations to describe changes in your choices. For example, some of the open strings attached to a D-brain like this will become fields on the D-brain, which tell you where the D-brain is. So, and you move in, as you move to perturbation theory, D-brains become, so they start their life as props, but they become dynamical objects with some mass, with some tension, which is very large, of order one of the one over the coupling, but they're still dynamical. Which means that suddenly they look like part of the theory. Mm-hmm.
Do D-brains always have to be extended in time?
Well, you can consider, in principle, I think D-brains which exist at an instant of time can contribute as, can play the role of instantons in the theory. So in principle, when you try to figure out what are the corrections to this perturbative expansion, you will have to include things like a D-brain instanton. Actually, there was something I was supposed to mention, I forget. Let me say it now. So it's possible to wonder, both for quantum theory and for string theory, if perturbation theory could be enough. So you might ask, OK, I have this perturbative expansion. OK, it's not convergent. It's asymptotic. It diverges. The terms blow up exponentially. But perhaps there is a way to resum it into something finite and meaningful. This is a very interesting problem in quantum theory and in string theory, even in quantum mechanics, which is still being studied quite actively. So I don't know what the answer is. How much could you use him? If you knew all perturbation, all the perturbative expansion, how much could you reconstruct the underlying theory? I don't quite know. In quantum mechanics, which people use as a toy model, you can use the perturbative expansion to figure out some of the instanton corrections, for example. And if you look at the general behavior of this perturbative expansion, you can guess that there will be some instanton corrections controlled by objects whose tension goes like one over the coupling, which is actually different from what happens in quantum field theory. Quantum field theory, depends on what you mean with coupling, but typically in quantum field theory, coupling squared is like, this coupling is like h bar. And in quantum field theory, you get things like e to the 1 over h bar, the tension, you know, classical objects have an action of which is proportional to 1 over h bar. In string theory, D-brains actually have a tension that goes like 1 over square root of h bar. Kind of funny. They're intermediate things between fully quantum mechanical and classical, which leads to all sorts of interesting phenomena, which we might be able to see. But anyway, going back here, right, these D-brains start becoming like dynamical objects. And also, if you look in certain corners, if you try to push string theory to places where it looks, where it seems to be breaking down, like when you take space-time and maybe you change the metric so it has some complicated singularity, typically you discover that the singularities you obtain have a very natural form. They look like what you would get in quantum field theory if you had integrated away some light field that you were not supposed to integrate away. And this light field can be identified with some Libre. So you can create situations so the theory is really telling you this Libre should have been there all along. They were really an intrinsic part of the original theory of closed strings. So D-brains don't give a way to change the theory. They just make manifest some aspects of the theory which are not obvious initially. And indeed, they allow, they sort of open little non-perturbative windows in the theory and are what allow us to draw pictures like this. See, what happens is that as you explore the space of couplings, some of the D-brains, which started as very tensionful, very massive objects, might become lighter at the same time as your strings become heavier. And you can get to situations where they can sort of get confused with each other. And as you explore different corners, what you're calling the string and what you're calling D-brains might be different. So that's answer the question, what happens to those discrete choices you make? Some of the some of those choices were really not a choice of theory, but a choice of which ingredient of the theory you're considering fundamental and which are you considering derived.
How are these color diagrams connected to the colors in the other? You just covered that board.
Oh, sorry, yes. Well, I tried to color each. So each D-brain tells you a choice of how the endpoints can behave. So here I was saying, OK, I was drawing a picture where there is an endpoint of one type, an endpoint of another type, an endpoint of another type. This picture that describes the scattering amplitude, where a string like, which I didn't draw, let me see. So this string, for example, has a purple and a yellow endpoint. So it would look like something like this, which is interacting with a string like this and with a closed string through some process, which ends up with a string of this sort and another closed string. See, the endpoint of these and the endpoint of these can merge. So you can get something stretched between the other two objects. This merging happens smoothly in space-time. So the fact that all of these processes can happen smoothly is the basic reason for this property. So in quantum field theory, UV divergences happen when interaction points come close to each other in space-time. So in theory, there are no interaction points. So nothing goes wrong as you explore your diagram. Okay, so. Mm-hmm.
If the method is dynamical, how can you have a time direction?
I was drawing space time, I wasn't.
Okay, sorry.
Also, here I was describing a perturbative process happening in flat space. Some of these could have been gravitons, but this would still describe an infinitesimal fluctuation in the flat space metric. You can, in principle, try to define some theory directly in a curved spacetime and do calculations in the curved spacetime. It is more challenging, and there are all sorts of interesting questions of what happens when time becomes complicated, when the space-time becomes complicated. If you have a space-time of the form time, maybe, I don't know, some flat space-time times something curved, and the flat spacetime includes time, calculations are much easier to understand. Notice that in quantum field theory, there are all sorts of observables you can study. You can study correlation functions, you can study scattering amplitude, and many other things. In flat space, scattering amplitudes are natural. You can also study correlation functions. In other spacetimes, different observables will be relevant. There might be spacetimes in which there is no asymptotic region, so no flat asymptotic region. So speaking about scattering amplitudes is not very meaningful. There are spacetimes like I discuss maybe later when I discuss ADS-CFT some of the alternative possibilities, but let's just say in general, we don't quite know what are the observables in quantum gravity, what are the questions that we can really ask in a truly dynamical space-time. String perturbation theory is not going to answer the question because it is defined within a specific space-time and then studying small fluctuations around it. So in a general space-time, I would not know what are the questions I should ask. But if I knew what questions to ask, I would, and they were perturbative, then I would probably be able to answer them with sufficient work. So the role of D-brains is, among others, to help making pictures like that meaningful. They provide extra degrees of freedom, which can become important in situations where regional description starts breaking down. Now, of course, when I draw these pictures, you should complain, because I just told you that string theory is defined through perturbation theory as a power series in G, how could I, which is not convergent. How could I possibly be exploring the interior of this picture and convince you that these theories might be connected if neither of them can be studied away from G equal to zero? So here, supersymmetry helps. So most of string theories that we know how to define and understand come equipped with supersymmetry, which is a symmetry which relates the bosons and the fermions of your theory. It's not a necessary property. You could study string theories which do not have supersymmetry. The cancellation of U divergences kind of tell you that there is some balance between bosons and fermions in your theory, because they contribute in the opposite way to loops. But the balance doesn't have to be exact. Supersymmetry sort of guarantees exact cancellations in favorable circumstances. So supersymmetry is just something that makes the theory easier to study. It allows you to prove that some quantities don't change as a function of the coupling, for example, or that some fields have no potential, or things like that. For example, if you have enough supersymmetry, your dilaton will have no potential, which means that you can study a universe where the dilaton has whatever value you want and it stays there. So you can meaningfully study perturbation theory without having to worry that your dilaton will go to values where the theory is not, where your methods are not valid anymore. And as I said, some quantities, like the mass of some particle, the tension of some objects, also have a dependence on the coupling, which is fully predictable once you have supersymmetry. So that's what allows pictures like this to be drawn. You cannot say what the whole theory does as you explore away from coupling. But for a handful of objects in a supersymmetric situation, you can predict that these objects will survive and will have certain properties, certain masses, certain tensions. And you can match them with the properties of objects in the other theories. And so, for example, you can see that, I don't know, some string here becomes some deeper in there, or vice versa. So this is how people can argue for these relations with different looking string theories, which are called dualities. So duality is a statement that some object might have different different looking descriptions. Dualities are not a property of string theory only. They occur in quantum field theory too. They are very interesting in quantum field theory. A lot of them have been discovered starting from string theory dualities. And indeed, one of the ways we learned a lot about supersymmetric quantum field theory has been historically to embed the theories within string theory by some judicious configuration of drains, which add the degrees of freedom you need to make the theory, and then using dualities of string theory to learn about properties of the quantum field theory. This is one of the applications to string theory beyond attempts to making it a theory of everything. So in general, supersymmetric theories are interesting. Well, they're interesting for two reasons. Again, there is, I'm not sure, a hope that they could be useful to describe the universe in the sense that some of the constellations they offer are an interesting way to understand some of the apparently fine-tuned properties of our universe. I'm not sure that perspective is viable anymore now that LHC has been has not been discovering anything beyond the standard model. And also supersymmetry is a great way to get toy models of things. Supersymmetric quantum field theories can be understood to a level of detail which is much greater than normal quantum field theories, but still show a lot of interesting dynamical phenomena which we would like to understand better. So we will touch on to supersymmetry only towards the very end of the course. Most of the lectures will be about bosonic string theory, which has no supersymmetry and is not well defined, but it's a great way to start. Towards the end of the course, we'll start defining type 2a, type 2b, maybe heterotic string. They're just a little bit technically challenging. Not terribly so, but a lot of the nice features of string theory are already visible in bosonic strings. The only unpleasant feature of bosonic string theory is that the lowest energy state is not there is a graviton, but the lowest energy state has negative mass squared and is a tachyon. So the bosonic string theory is not self-consistent, but you can still do calculations of some things. It's just unstable. It describes some metastable object, some metastable universe. We don't quite know what it would decay to, and if it actually makes sense. Now, I wanted to mention briefly something about ADS-CFT. So ADS-CFT was born out of string theory, although has gone well beyond that at the moment. It's somehow the mechanism that somehow it's born as a self-consistent relation between different ways of thinking about open strings and D-brains. Somehow, as I said, D-brains have a sort of intermediate scale because their tension behavior like square root of h bar. Now, if you put a lot of them in the same place, you can create a configuration which is classical, some classical deformation of your space-time. And you might ask how this, but on the other hand, you could have described this classical deformation of space-time just by going back to the original theory and modifying, say, the metric in which your strings are moving. So the fact that these two perspectives are simultaneously valid means that somehow you can use D-brains and open string sectors to mimic properties of curved space-time. And if you distill this idea, and if you're Maldacena, you get to the observation that some quantum field theories can be equivalent to some theories of gravity. So the statement of the DSCFT is that if you look at theories of gravity on a space called anti de Sitter, which is a negatively curved space-time, which is kind of it's a funny space-time. It has properties which are very different from flat space. It has a boundary, which is, and in a sense, studying a theory of gravity in anti de Sitter space is like putting it in a box. So there is a boundary, and instead of studying things like scattering amplitudes, what you can do is to sort of change boundary conditions a little bit at points of the boundary and see what happens. These changes in boundary condition will propagate, will create some excitations which will propagate in. And so the basic observable of these theories of gravity is what happens if I modify things at some points on the boundary. So and if you look at how this answer look like, they look a lot like correlation functions of a quantum field theory at the defined at the boundary, where the operation that you did locally on the boundary becomes some local operator in the quantum field theory. This quantum field theory so lives in some space which has dimension d, because so the whole inside of space-time can be replaced by quantum field theory living just at the boundary of space-time. Right, so there are, if you take a generic quantum field theory, you can try to interpret it like this, but you don't get something that looks like a quantum gravity in the sense that it does not have a nice, smooth, weakly curved interior. So, but some spatial quantum field theories have this property. Now, I think all the quantum field theories which have this property have been derived from string theory. And so, almost by construction, the interior is a string theory. And so, these quantum field theories give you a non-perturbative definition of string theory in a box, which, you know, if you study the weak coupling, has precisely the kind of expansion. Now, I find it very puzzling, the fact that, so there are many different boxes you can use somehow, you know, different choices of boundary conditions. And each of these boundary conditions give you a different quantum field theory, which gives a different non-perturbative definition of the string theory in that box. I find it very strange to have many different non-perturbative definitions, which depend on what I'm doing at infinity. Now, in quantum field theory, you get used to this idea that there are some underlying microscopic laws of physics, right? And then they propagate out in scale and determine the large energy, the large scale behavior of physics. But here, it's weirder. Like the underlying laws depend on what you're doing at large distances. It's probably a property of quantum gravity, but I have no good understanding of what it really implies. But just to say that there are a lot of interesting questions in quantum gravity. Some of them can be expressed in string theory, but a lot of them are probably more general than that. Some of the lessons that you're going to learn in string theory are probably true in general. For example, take some other theory of quantum gravity that you might have produced. Let me assume for a moment that it's compatible with some negative curvature. OK, this is questionable. You might say, no, my theory of quantum gravity does only positive curvature, and that's fine because the universe is positively curved. That's OK, because the universe has a positive curvature is like 10 to the minus 100 and something. You might wonder if it would be possible to have at least some metastable situation where the negative curvature was. I mean, if you have a theory of gravity, you might wonder if it's possible to disconceivably put it in a negative curved space-time. If that's the case, and if your theory of quantum gravity has gravity at low energy, then it's automatic that when you put it in anti-de Sitter space, it will have a quantum field theory dual. And then a lot of the properties that we liked about string theory are actually following from the quantum field theory dual. For example, if you have a family of such theories, you have a family of quantum field theories. Families of quantum field theories are typically obtained from each other by deformations by some local operators. But these local operators create excitations and give you low energy particles, which make those properties fluctuate, and so on. So I think it's likely that a lot of the things we're learning in string theory will be true more generally. And ADS-CFT is a good way to gain intuition about that. OK, any more questions? OK, let's see you tomorrow.